Welcome to the Fabric Podcast. We're in a conversation helping each of us develop insights and understanding to increase our care IQ. Hopefully it sparks your own thoughts and spills into conversations. For related resources, go to fabricmpls.com.
Hi, I'm Chris, and I get to hang out with you this morning. We're in the conversation series about care IQ, and those of us that have witnessed a situation that care needs to happen. And really what care IQ is about is the care we need to receive for ourselves or the care that we witness in another person. It's bigger than the normal, and yet we don't really know how to address it. We don't really know how to walk alongside our friends, our family, ourselves as we need to receive care or feel like care needs to be received by someone else. And so as a community, we have committed to this conversation series and hopefully beyond to how do we talk about care? What kind of language do we use? And we're not here to give answers. We realize that these situations are complex and unique. And yet we're here to talk about what are the tools we can really utilize and lean into as we think about care IQ. So care IQ situations are when we realize that care needs to flow from one person to another. Now, the key for understanding this is that all of us are both caregivers and care receivers. We both need to receive care from other people, and we also have the opportunity to give care to other people. And so as we kind of talk about Care IQ, we've been talking about this for the last 3 weeks. So if you are listening to the podcast, you might want to pause it now and take some time to listen to some of the other conversations that we've had. But one of the big tools that we've developed, actually six of them, you'll have in your Sunday paper, and they'll be available online as well. The reality is they require practice. And sorry to say it to you, but my hunch is it takes a lifetime and probably more. And so as we are addressing these type of situations, as we are becoming present to them, it's about opening ourselves up to that. And so I'm inviting someone up to help us have that conversation who has dedicated their life to Care IQ. So Verlin Hemmen is I don't know how to say it beyond a mentor, a role model, the person in my life that is the reason or one of the reasons why I'm here. He's part of my circle. Verlin started his career as a pastor and then moved into chaplaincy, which is what I do. I'm a chaplain. And then he moved into training other people how to be chaplains, how to do this Care IQ, and kind of just has a passion and a gift for teaching us how to do Care IQ kind of situations. And so he's going to kind of come up and talk through what does this look like. So thanks for being here, Verlin, first of all.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So we just have a few questions to start off with. So the first one that I really just want to know is why commit your life to Care IQ? What about it is important to you?
That's easy. That was for the money. No, I'm kidding. Totally. I think it goes back, as most stuff does, to my childhood when the grandfather that always called me little preacher as a little boy died when I was 5 years old. And I was so aware of the feelings of sadness I had and the grief I had about this mentor and shaping person that I had some really difficult prayers with God at night. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. I'm thinking about this at five. And it never changed. I started having a pet cemetery. I buried all my pets and I did the eulogy for them because I was the pastor, obviously. And then along about my junior high years, a family friend moved into our home. And you have to understand, this was a small farmhouse in Iowa, three bedrooms. My sister had one bedroom, my parents had the other, and guess where this guy slept? The abuse happened, started almost immediately, went on for a year and a half. And I was this guy who knew he was going to be a minister and could not figure out how God could let something like that happen to me. And so after fighting with God for a long time, I think I finally just, I decided it was my fault. And what a lot of abuse victims do is they turn inside and try to fix it and hide it and heal it. My lovely wife, Kay, is sitting right up here front. She didn't know anything about this when we met or when we got married. She didn't know anything about it. I didn't tell anybody for 35 years. But what that did to me was to create a kind of perfectionism, if you will, to try to atone for my responsibility for this horrible thing that happened. And it almost killed me. Some of what life in parish ministry can be like is it can be really challenging and really hard. And I tried to do everything right. And I soon learned that the worst place in the world to try to make everybody happy is in a church. So I started therapy. And the other odd thing that I would say is that I think people sensed in me my woundedness, even though I never acknowledged it. And I started having people come talk to me about their problems, their struggles, their pain. And I found out pretty fast that even though I'd been a psych major in college, I didn't know a thing about people. And so I started reading books, going to school to try to train to get smarter about who we are and how we function. All the time, I think I was really trying to heal myself, but that didn't really work. I think I was helpful to some people. I don't know. I just got more tired trying to care for more and more people. But I was amazed, too, at how many people had stories of woundedness. When I stood up in front of a communion table on Sunday and saw people come forward and I knew their stories, I thought, oh, my goodness, look at all these wounded folks here, and I wonder if anybody else knows. And it was then that I sort of committed to, I want to have a ministry that's focused on spiritual and emotional health. And I started doing study for another degree around marriage and family therapy, and then entered into the chaplaincy thing where I got to practice a lot. Because people who are in the hospital know that they've got an issue, and they're willing to talk about it quite often. So that's a really long answer, Chris.
I loved it.
Oh, okay. Well, you have to.
Yeah, no, that's true. So my second question, and you kind of mentioned this, is that these Care IQ situations, although beautiful and what you've committed your life to, they require, as we've talked about, self-maintenance. And So what are some tools for self-maintenance that you've used kind of throughout your career and life to make this sustainable?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm kind of listing them in the heavy one first. The first one was therapy. Every church I worked at, and I worked at three of them, I had a therapist. And that was me still trying to figure stuff out and sort out my own brain. So therapy is great, but not everybody is cut out for therapy or can afford therapy or in a position to do therapy. So then it became small groups. The other thing that happened to me in every job I've had is I've had a small group of friends that I met with on a regular basis, and we read books. And if I had to do it all over again, I would start right now with a small group reading this little book, and I meant to bring a copy of it called How to Be an Adult. It's so good and so hard. It takes really a year to work through this tiny little volume because it's all about how do you deal with your emotional health. So small groups were essential to me. Having a really good friend, and I was very fortunate to have a spouse who understood my working situation, and I felt like I could always talk to her about what I was experiencing in that situation. Grateful for that. But there are other things that you can do that are a lot less heavy like that. I was just sharing a bit ago that my love for folk music has probably saved me many times. I go into a zone, put my headphones on, hear Peter Mayer. Some of you know Peter from Stillwater. There are many other wonderful folk musicians. If you don't like folk music, poetry can really do it. Takes me outside of myself. Taking a walk is really important. There's a whole theory of psychotherapy that's been developed by someone who took a walk and noticed that as she moved her eyes from side to side, she didn't feel as bad about her problem. If you've ever heard of EMDR, that's how that developed. It's the most effective tool we have to deal with post-traumatic stress syndrome right now. So taking a walk is a great way to find healing. And then, as it says, I ride a Harley. I figured out, though, that riding a Harley is really an EMDR treatment. because when you're on a motorcycle, you can't trust anybody else. So my eyes are going like this the whole time. And then when I get off the bike, I feel better. So I think I should be doing commercials for Harley, frankly. Maybe I just did. I don't know.
You sold me. I
sold
got one.
You got so, one too, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. I was wondering when you handed me the How to Be an Adult book, I thought that was a personal shot, but I guess you...
At the time, it was.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Have you started yet?
Jenny? So Greg talked a little last week about putting the weight back on another person, and as we've had kind of discussions in my small group, and I knew you were kind of where that came from, and yet can you help us unpack that idea a little bit more?
Yeah, I think we can get caught up in the words. I think the reason I use those phrases in my own head is just to keep reminding myself that this is not my problem. And that's a hard thing to say. I think when people come to us with issues, the first thing that I want to do is, oh, give me that problem and I'll hold it and keep it for you. And, oh, and I'll take yours too. And pretty soon I get 10 or 12 problems on my back. And the other person feels better and I feel worse. So really what this notion is about how do I empower that person to work with their stuff in their time and with their resources in a way that doesn't make me feel worse about who I am and what I'm doing. And the metaphor I'd want to give to you, I think, is how do I become a mirror so that this person can see themselves more clearly than they're able to see themselves right now? And so what I mean by that is that if somebody says, I feel so depressed, I might say to them, wow, you feel so depressed. Tell me more about depression. And what else do you know about that? And I see you right now. You know, your head's down. You're looking at the floor a lot. You're fidgeting. Is that what depression is for you? So all of those kinds of phrases are to reflect back to them how you're experiencing them without ever saying to myself, oh, no, I've got a depressed person on my hands. What do I do now? Because I don't know what to do with depression quite often. Now, I may get to the point, I want to add a caveat to that if somebody is suicidal, I'm, you know, there's an old story. Carl Rogers was the person who develops a form of psychology that's reflected back everything that the patient said. And so the patient comes in to see the therapist, and the patient says, oh, I'm feeling suicidal. And the therapist says, oh, you're feeling suicidal, huh? Yeah, I'm thinking about jumping out this window. Oh, you're thinking about jumping out that window, huh? Yeah, here I go. Oh, there you go. That's not helpful. So there are times when interventions have to take place, and if you're looking for an exact science or a formula for figuring that out, there aren't any. But I keep reflecting it back until I'm pretty clear in my own head that this person is at the end of their rope and they need an intervention. Now, that doesn't happen a lot. But we are aware that it happens more than we wished it would. And so figuring out how can I reflect back and help this person see themselves, and I think of the reflection as sort of like creating a sacred space for them. And another way I would like to think about, remember the department store mirrors that had several sides to it, like you stepped into it, and you could almost see your own butt from where you were standing? That's kind of what I want to do. I want to give them different angles and perceptions of who they are so that they can really assess, am I really that depressed, or is this just a tough time and I've lived through tough times before? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay. I think that's really helpful to unpack that a little bit further. Okay. and see that from a different angle.
Wow, he's good.
Trying to reflect back.
Yeah. Oh.
So we've talked throughout this series and about kind of the importance of presence. Mm-hmm. And presence with each other. And one of the biggest things in chaplaincy is we call it the ministry of presence. So the gift that we can give to other people is just us showing up and being there. Now, one of the struggles that I have with that is that I've been the care receiver before and had someone just sit there in silence and feel like they're just watching me or kind of keeping tabs on me in some weird way. And so how do we kind of unpack that healthy versus unhealthy or helpful versus unhelpful silence? What is that? How do you see the difference between those two?
Well, one of the things I would say about that is I challenged every student I've had, and I challenge myself always to be clear about who am I and why am I here. And not only do I think it in my own head, but I say it to people. If I'm doing chaplain work, I say, hi, I'm part of the spiritual care team, and I'm here to support you through this really difficult time. Sometimes that means that I sit with people in silence. And sometimes it means that we talk a lot about a lot of different things, how they're feeling, what they're thinking, all of those kinds of things. I'm not sure what would be most helpful to you right now, but I want you to know that I'm here to support you. And then I might go quiet if they don't respond. And then if it's been quiet for as long as I can stand it, because you do get anxious with silence sometimes, I might just say, and here's probably one of the fundamental things, can you trust your own reactions and be honest enough to share them with people? So can you say to that person, I just realized that I've sat here now for 5 minutes and neither one of us said anything, and I want you to know that I'm perfectly fine with that, but I wanted to check in with you to see how that is for you. Does that make sense? So I'm always checking, and I'm gonna use a phrase, I don't know if you were gonna talk about this later, but we talked occasionally about contracting. And that word has a nasty feel to it. But what in my head, what I'm thinking is, what is the agreement that the person I'm talking to and I have? And there's often a lot of unconscious agreements. Like one of them is, I'm going to tell you my problem, and you're going to fix it. No. That's not the contract. So that's why I want to define why I'm here. I'm here to care for you and support you during this time. And then to get clear, so what would support be like for you right now? How would you know that I was caring for you or supporting you? That's always renegotiating the contract, even around time. I'm going to be here for the next half hour, and say that half hour goes by, I might say, wow, I just noticed we've been talking, and this has really been great, and I said to you at the beginning that I'd be here for like a half hour. How is this for you? Do you want me to stay longer, or what would make most sense to you? So that's a big, big piece of it in my mind is being honest. If a person's quiet, I want to honor and respect that. We've all been there where we don't want people talking to us. Sometimes it can be comforting to have somebody just sitting there, but you're right. Sometimes it feels like they're just kind of lurching in your space. And so to be able to give them permission, one of my favorite things about the hospital is that when patients threw us out of the room, I always thought, great, they got to make one decision today that a doctor or nurse didn't tell them to do. So if somebody throws me out, tells me to go home, that's just fine. I don't have anything at stake in this. My goal is to support you and to care for you, and I need to hear from you what that would look like or how that would work best.
I think that's the contracting deal is one in which I know I struggle with, and I think it's one of those that makes sense when you say it out loud, but there's something about, I think, my pride that makes me want to have all of the answers right away of saying, well, I can read you well enough to know what that contract is without us saying it out loud.
Yeah.
And I think the reminder that part of the practice is to have that conversation and to have that agreement in a verbal way between two people.
Yeah. Chapter 3 of that adult book.
Oh, that's what it is. I knew I skipped that chapter.
Just kidding.
This is a question that just came up for me. And one of these things that I have kind of a question about is this, in this series in general, and Greg kind of talked about this, we haven't quoted the Bible much, and we haven't kind of talked too much about as we talk about it here at Fabric, the God strand, and yet, I feel that presence in those situations probably more so than any other. And I'm just wondering how, you know, for someone who was 4 years old and convinced they were going to be a pastor, do you feel like a failure now that you were a chaplain instead and aren't talking about God all the time, or how do you?
It's a great question. An old girlfriend of mine at a high school reunion, when I told her I was a chaplain now, she said, oh, you sold out. Needless to say, that's probably one of the reasons we broke up. I think like most of us, as we keep wrestling with what faith means, my definition gets broader and broader. And so we have actually a code of ethics as chaplains that says we don't proselytize and we respect everybody's theological orientation. We used to say we support anybody's spiritual practice, whether they have a faith or not. And that's a complicated thing to say. So my task is not to project my stuff. And I have to be really careful with that, because what works for me doesn't work probably for anybody else in this room. And so my task is to figure out things like, what, tell me about your life. What in the past, have you ever been in a circumstance like this before? And what got you through then? And some people will say, I prayed and prayed and prayed and had every prayer team I know have me on their prayer list. And other people would say, well, I started with vodka. And, you know, and so I find out where their place of support originally came from. And so, oh, vodka, what got you from there to where you are today? Well, I realized that that wasn't fixing anything. And so I did some therapy. And then to say, is there anything else that brought you support? And some people have a very elaborate theology, and others have none. And I don't. My goal wasn't to give them one, was to but to assess what it was that gave them hope, and then to reconnect them to that, if possible. How is that still a part of your life today, I might say? Well, it's different. Okay, tell me about how it's different, and how is that helping you today? So I try to honor people's faith traditions as well as I can. And if they ask me really pointed questions, I will explain where I'm at. But I don't ever assume that what works for me works for anybody else.
That's helpful. If you were to give kind of two techniques or two thought process for any of us as we enter into Care IQ type of situations, do you have kind of some that come up that are the can't miss kind of techniques?
Well, the first one, I don't know if it's a can't miss, but it's generally to slow down. I think we get anxious, and anxiety is the bane of most relationships. And so when somebody comes to me with a problem, my question is, how do I slow myself down and really hear it? And that might include then getting further definition or explanation. When somebody says a word like, I'm depressed, I don't know what that word means to them. And so if I jump in with my definition of depression, might be calling 911 for fear of a suicide. And that might not mean what they mean at all. So my task is to slow down and say, wow, really depressed. Now tell me more about that. What does that mean to you? So that they can get clearer themselves and understand it, and so that I can understand it, that if I have to do something or offer something, I'm much clearer about what it is that might be needed. So slow down would be the first thing. Secondly, I would say is figure out how to go back to something. Sometimes people go down rabbit trails, and you're way over here on some other issue with dad over here, and you wondered about this over here. So I think it's very okay to say, could we call a timeout a minute? I was just aware that we were talking about this, and then we jumped over to this subject. And I wasn't sure if there was something more that needed to be said here or not. Could you help me know what's best here right now? And so that gives them permission to go back. And maybe they were bumping up against something really hard, and they didn't want to talk there. But I'm letting them know that I listen to them and that I'm willing to go there if they want to go there. So that's the second one. The third one that comes to my mind is apologizing. And hopefully you don't have to do that a lot, but I find that it's I do, because I make assumptions and leaps, and sometimes I make people uncomfortable, either with my silence or my talking. And when I can sense it in them, I try to have my radar out to see, did their gaze just move to another part of the room? Did they fidget when I said something? I might stop for a moment and just say, gosh, maybe it's just me, but I noticed just now that our conversation kind of took a veer here, kind of changed, and I don't know, maybe it's me again, but you seemed a little different. Was there something I said just now that didn't sit right with you or didn't work right for you? Because that's not my goal at all. My goal is to be here and support you and care for you. And if I did anything, I'm sorry, I don't want to do that. I'd like to step back and start over again, if you don't mind. That make sense? And maybe it sounds easy. It's not easy. It's really a dose of humble pie that I have to eat, admitting that I stepped out of bounds or out of the way, and then to say, let's go back, because none of us are perfect at this. This is really hard work, and so just stopping and asking to go back can be a real, real gift to the other person.
Yeah. So we're going to kind of move to the next section of this, and so we want to invite you all to be a part of this process. So we realize that practicing Care IQ is really hard and feels uncomfortable, and so Verlin, Melissa, and myself are going to embrace that discomfort and make fools of ourselves in front of you all, and so we're going to do a little bit of role plays, and we would like your help in that. So if you could take out your phone. One is if you have any questions that are hot for you right now that you'd really like to just have asked in front of everybody. Again, we can't track it back to you, so feel free to just ask it. The second is, as I said, we're going to try to do some role playing. So if you can think of a Care IQ situation that you dread, that like you are just terrified of, maybe it's in real life, maybe it's just the idea of one, and just kind of write out what that scenario would look like with as much or as little detail as you'd like, and we're gonna try to act out a little bit of what that would look like for us to kind of work through. First of all, we got a lot of responses, so thank you all. It's pretty amazing that we have a community that's willing to address this stuff, because that's quite a unique gift. So thank you for being that. So the second is our pattern here at Fabric in going into these situations is to learn about them. So that's what we've been doing for the last few weeks and so far today, practice them and then reflect on what that looks like. So we're going to kind of lean into this right now. And as I said, we had a lot of scenarios. So if we don't get to yours, I apologize, and we'll maybe think of other ways we can address these type of situations moving forward. So we're going to do a little role play. Melissa and Verlin, Melissa's going to be the caregiver here. Verlin's going to be the care receiver, and we're going to kind of reflect a little bit on what do we do when we think something is wrong with somebody, but they're only willing to give you the Minnesota, I'm fine. And what does that look like?
So there were quite a few things that we might be able to, that we heard, that we might be able to wrap into this. And one of the benefits of this, you see us learning in public and messing up, and we'll all reflect together on that.
So give us grace, please.
Yep. Okay. Hey, Verlin.
Hey, Melissa.
How's it going?
Yeah, good.
Yeah. Well, this is hard.
Yeah, I gotta go now.
I had a few minutes, and I wanted to just see you again. It's been a while. I know you were I just felt like you maybe felt a little down last week when I saw you and wondered how you're doing today and wondered if it would be helpful to just talk about it more or if I can be supportive today in any way or just being with you.
You don't want to hear about my junk.
Feel like there's junk?
Yeah, it's my job, it's my family, good grief, it's like nothing I do seems to be going right. I'm going broke. I don't like to put that on people. I'm sorry. I just did. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, I came because I care and want to see if there's any way that we can together be in this and that you don't have to be alone.
feels pretty lonely, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how...
Can I time out for a second?
Yeah, please.
Man, I love doing this role.
So my tendency in that one, I was thinking about Verlin's idea of slowing down. So can I jump in as the caregiver? And
yes.
Verlin, I heard you mention a few different scenarios, and I'm feeling kind of overwhelmed by the ways that you are kind of addressing so many different things at once. Is there one in particular we can talk about for a little bit?
Hmm. Well, now that you mention it, it's my marriage. I'm really getting concerned about that, if we're going to make it.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah. That feels like an awful place to be.
It is. I never thought we'd get there. She's at work all the time. I don't trust the guys she works around. I don't know. I don't know what to do. I try to talk to her, but I just get mad, and it doesn't feel like we get anything solved, and I don't know. Could you fix it for me?
And I think that's kind of to time out again. That's the part where I feel that tendency to want to jump in and want to give solutions, kind of pry a little bit more than I need to into what that marriage looks like. And I think one of the things that kind of was brought up in the questions is that concern of when a spousal kind of argument is happening, to not get roped into that. And so what my tendency would be there is to focus on the ways in which the care receiver there is processing it themselves, and try to focus that energy on them, as opposed to moving towards the spouse and trying to jump all over that type of a situation.
It's a lovely time to do a quick comment about the power of triangles. If you don't know about relational triangles, this is an important time to talk about them, I think. Here's the theory. Whenever two people's relationship gets too stressed, they triangulate in a third person or thing to keep them stuck exactly where they are. So I've seen triangulation happen over jobs, children, sports, boats. Golf was a popular one. It's a way to keep the relationship stuck. And so if somebody comes to you and brings your problem about their spouse or their friend or even their job, you're a prime suspect to be pinned with the triangle thing. And that's where this whole non-anxious presence thing comes about. And how do you say, well, this isn't my problem. This is a problem between you and your spouse or you and your boss. And how do I keep that focus there so that I don't assume responsibility and keep you stuck? You know, so then I have to get really curious about, wow, that sounds awful. What do you think you're going to be doing with all that? Putting it back to them to figure out, because I can't do anything with it.
I think one of the common themes that we just saw with these questions, and kind of my last kind of brief place I want to go is this fear of working with people who are dying or that are terminally ill, and that fear of how do we remain present to that. And I think one of the things that I kind of reflect on as someone who does that work is that you have to deal with your own mortality and realizing that death is a part of life. I work at a children's hospital and work with kids who are dying, and I have two awesome children, and I've realized that my anxiety is raised when that child is a similar age to mine.
Dealing with death is obviously a big deal, but you don't know how people are thinking about it. You know, you don't know what they envisioned. Like, you know, if I sat you all down and said, tell me about what you think your perfect death scenario would be for yourself, you know, are you thinking Thelma and Louise? Yeah, are you having fun with that, right? You know, very few people think of laying on a bed in a hospital semi-conscious and fading out that way. We want to go out, many of us, in a blaze of glory, right? that's not likely to happen. So exploring that, and I think there again, it's our own anxiety that gets in the way about, is it okay for people to talk about dying? Well, of course it is. It's just really hard. And to be able to say, so wow, you've got a horrible diagnosis here. Tell me, what is that doing to you? And by the way, that question, what is that doing to you, gets to the clean question thing that we haven't talked about today, but the cleanest question you can ever ask anybody is this: how are things? Because I didn't ask for a feeling, I didn't ask for a thought, I didn't ask for anything really from them except how are things. And how that person answers that question informs everything I do next.
That kind of relates to one of the things that came in. How do you enter a helping conversation with someone who defaults to an emotional mindset when you operate from more of a analytical mindset?
Yeah. So if that's true, and I know that's true for a lot of people, that you tend to think more logically than emotionally, it still you have the responsibility, I think, to normalize an emotional response, to say, wow, you seem really quite worked up about this, and that makes sense to me. I have to tell you that that's not my forte, but I also want to tell you that I want to care for you in this moment and understand, what does that mean for you to feel so afraid like that? Tell me more about that. You can be the learner. That's the thing that I always thought about chaplaincy, was sort of like walking into a library, and every person I see in every room is a book on the shelf, and I don't know anything about that book until I take it off the shelf and start reading it. And that's the way I think about people. I don't know anything about them until they start telling me. And so with a situation with death, I don't know what they've imagined about their death. I don't know if they have regrets or fears or hopes. Or some people are actually honestly excited about the prospect of dying. In their theology, that's very comforting for them, to think that this world is over and they're going to a better place. So I don't want to mess any of that up. I just want to understand it and support them in that process of understanding and doing it. Does that make sense? I really want to acknowledge somebody expressed concern about physical danger. And I just want to say really clear that if you have some sense of that, trust that reaction in your body. And if you can give words to it, I would do that, to say, I'm a little anxious about how things are right now between us. Can you tell me that I'm going to be okay and that we're going to be okay in this time? And putting it out there and saying it is, I think, important stuff. And if you don't get the answer that makes you feel better, get out the door. That's just my take on that. It's no badge of honor to be hurt by somebody that's physically violent.
Berlin, there's so much represented here.
Yeah.
And a lot of caring. A lot of you care about a lot of people and a lot of things. And all of us are hurting and holding things, sometimes for very long, long, long hauls, long roads.
Yeah.
And we don't see hope. It's hard to see hope sometimes.
Yep.
So if you could just help us close with like a little bit of slowing down, I think we could, that might help.
So a thing that has been helpful to me when I felt the stress is that I've thought about people in my childhood and in my younger years who were present for me in a difficult time. And when I start thinking about those folks, Cleo comes to mind real fast, a person named Bob. These folks didn't take away any of my struggle or problem. They were just with me and guided me in my processing of what I was going through. And I think it can be a helpful exercise for all of us to stop every once in a while and say, who are the people that loved me into the person I've become today? Who are the people who were there for me when I was going through a really tough time? And what were the things that they did? How were they present with me in a way that got me to a new place, a stronger place, a happier, healthier place, if you will? And I would conjure up a visual image of that person, if you could, and notice how they're probably smiling at you right now, thinking, look at you, look at who you've become. And enjoy the fact that they cared for you and really offered you a gift that is now your opportunity to give to others. That loving, caring presence that is, if we believe nothing else, we believe that love is transformational. And if we can enter into that kind of relationship with another person, to being a presence of love towards them, it can be transformational.
Wow. Yeah.
I feel that.
Thanks for listening. Keep this conversation going with the people in your life. Share this podcast and resources. You can find a link to a printable bookmark of the Care IQ tools in the description. We'd also be grateful for a 5-star rating and review, or for you to consider investing in this work by visiting fabricmpls.com/give. If you're in the Twin Cities on a Sunday morning, you can join us at 10:30 at Field Community School. The address is 4645 4th Avenue South, where you'll find age-appropriate opportunities for kids and these conversations happening live.